Why don't, yeah, I would, somebody else take over and facilitate, please.
No,
Rudy, please, introduce me.
Oh. Well, I just said before we take this note in silence, it's my pleasure. This is your father. You have to come out with a buffer. Yeah. That's a and she is late in the diocese. She's a long-time organist.
What does it mean,
Bhavana?
Also, you have to say.
Well, Bhavana is from the root bhu, which means to be.
Yeah.
And Bhavana, I mean, you'll tell the form. somebody who is in permanent development, is growing in being.
It's from Kauvatesa, to help somebody be. Yeah?
Or to help somebody.
It's the God being. And it can be meditation, partially meditation, to go to some extent to the deepest conceivement of one's own self. Or it can be also support and imagination and many other means.
So let me conclude with exactly this quality that Bahama today comes to meet and talk about how it feels to be.
I want to say one more thing here. That we are having today a sociological approach to knowledge. And that is an important part because we don't want to introduce only what we do. We also want to see how all these approaches differ from each other and how they enhance our holistic development. Integral knowledge, which we may have at the end, glimpse of. So, in this way, I would encourage speakers to always have that perspective, not only to introduce their material, but also to pay attention to the particular way of knowing, particular way of dealing with material, which has to be clear for all of us.
Thank you. I'm going to do that. At first, when I found what I was going to present called sociological approach to knowledge, I thought. But I've never studied sociology. But I've done this work of being sort of on the interface between Oroville and villages for quite a while, and I had thought of it, and it has spurred many, sprouted several ideas. So I have a talk which is in a couple of parts, and it's fortunate that since John Robert, who was instrumental, he actually is someone with a master's degree in anthropology, I believe, but he encouraged me a lot in participating in Yuhu and in this way, and he has also put together, and we'll come to it when he comes back, a very nice visual presentation of some of the more conceptual things which I'm talking about. But I'm starting out with a sort of souped-up version of my talk that I give to newcomers or guests when they come to a class on Oroville Villages and Human Unity. Because mostly people, and we ourselves may even be asking this question sometimes, why is it that a bunch of highly idealistic and egalitarianly disposed people came to Oroville, but what you see now is a sort of what can be look like a neo-colonialistic situation in which the rich and educated outsiders are being waited on by the local people. What happened to our egalitarianism? And I was here from the beginning. Actually, Oroville began in 68, and I was here in 71. And I watched it happen, actually, but without only in hindsight can I describe it. While it was happening, I was just part of it happening. I think it's important to recall how very, very, very poor it was here when we moved on the land. the Tenzi and has given a good he's shown the pictures of what the land looked like. It was barren, it was eroding, and it was actually, there was a geologist at the time who said, if something's not done here in 20 years, this place will not support human life, because it was eroding. And the people too were very poor, which now if we look at the villages, we may also say, but they're so poor, their houses are not nice, and their dress is not nice, and they, but that was, this what is now existing is so much better than it was then. When it was then, babies had distended stomachs, children, from malnutrition. Their hair was brown instead of black from malnutrition. Their skin was flaky. In some houses, the women had to take turns leaving the house because they only had one sari between them. Everybody was skinny. It looked like the whole, like the Tamil race was a skinny race. It isn't, actually. It's when there's enough food around, it's a good, hefty race. Everyone was skinny. It was a very, very impoverished situation. And most of us, a lot of us, had been traveling in India before we ended up in Oroville. And we were used to a lot of begging. But how did the villagers come to us? I'll tell you. They came and said, any work? It might be their only two words of English, but that's what they were coming and saying to us in the morning. And I don't think any of us knew much about the way intentional communities should be formed. Intentional communities, if we know about it now, that everybody should be committed to the ideals and everybody should share all the work and we should all experience all the work that is involved so that we have a good understanding of what's involved in running our community. We didn't know about that. There were some people who felt instinctively, no, we shouldn't hire people. But most of us, and I was one of them, felt, how can we say no when a hungry person comes and says, any work? And there's so much work. There was so much work. The Aurevillians started digging the hole for Matra Mandir. After several months, there was still barely more than a scratch in the ground. It took Govindaswamy and his huge team of, I don't know how many, 100 people?
400.
400 to come and dig and carry and dig and carry and dig and carry and dig make the hole. That's just an example. Almost all the trees that have been planted by villagers who were paid to dig a 1 meter by 1 meter by 1 meter hole at, say, 4 rupees a hole. And you'd have to go and measure the hole and make sure that it was the right size and bargain with them and all that sort of thing. But that's how we did it. And what happened was that the natural laws the natural division of labor overtook and dominated our egalitarian preferences, because the people who could come in and dig all day in the soil and dig those holes for the trees also tell us what to plant and when and do all manner of manual tasks. A few of them picked up English, young boys usually, and they would then become the right-hand man, and they would progress. But most of the people actually weren't interested in learning; they were interested in earning, and they took their wages home. And when we couldn't pay them because there was some glitch and the money didn't come out from the society in Pandi, they would go away smiling, saying, we'll come back on Monday, it's all right. We trust you, you will pay us, and we did usually. So they did the work, they took the money home, they fed their families, but they didn't become, it didn't work. Like, we tried. There were several times when there were several attempts, I don't know how many, more than I know of people who said, well, let's have tea together. Let's have this break together. But it didn't work. There was no language. There was no shared language. And the interests are very different. And the difference in the mindset I'll go into, that question remained in my mind all along. And I've got some attempts at, not answers, but a way of looking at it. Orvillians were, they were not unaware of the needs of the villages. They tended to interpret it in their own way. Now, the first and foremost thing we did for the development of the villages was employment.
What?
Employment. We provided employment. And then people had disposable income and they could buy what they wanted and do what they wanted with that. So it was actually an empowering, the most empowering way of dealing with poverty is employ and pay. The other very important thing that many, many people were involved with was the education of the young people. There was like something in Aurevillians just reached out and said, these kids should have an education. They should learn to read and write. They should have a world, a possibility of stepping into a world that is bigger and more interesting and more developed than the village poverty. And so there were several schools that were set up by Aurevillians where village kids went to school. And I'm not going to list them all, but one of the setters up was Rod. And I often tell the story about a little boy named Tandapani, who was herding goats and cows, and he would sit himself on Rod's threshold every morning and not let Rod go out until he taught him to read something. Tandapani is now a trustee of the Oralette Trust. It's
he was a very gifted artist.
Yeah. And there were many like that. Rood said that he felt that many people, some of us got born all over the world and traveled to Oroville, but some people were so eager to get to Oroville that they got born in the villages. And for instance, Raman. I always think of Raman when I tell that story. But there are others. There are people, Dhanapal, that really chose somehow. So there was a big problem when, like, at a certain point, I felt that there was a missing dimension here. That Oroville, as a community, was not developing a relationship with the villages as communities. And so I began to look into that with several other people, including eventually some professional social workers. But the first thing that became evident, and my ability to put words around this is very late. In the beginning I had no concept for this, but later it became very clear that not only in the villages around Oroville, but in the villages all over India and probably all over Africa and South America, the people who had been responsible for carrying on the culture, for managing the communal resources, and for doing the planning and also the artisans, the people who were making the things, all those people had left the village. They had, especially under the British rule, they'd moved to the cities. Urbanization, that's where the good schools were for your children. That's where interesting jobs were. That's where an opportunity to be part of what looked like a new wave of something happening in India was happening. And who was left in the villages were the people who had been born and bred for thousands of years to take orders only. And this meant that when Aurevillians went to try to find the village leadership for instance, a villager drives a bunch of cows and goats into your newly planted tree plantation, they eat up all the trees, you grab one goat and say, "Oh, happy, I'm going to go to the village and get justice." And they would have a hard time finding any leadership, because the leadership of that class of people is actually a leadership only around doing the temple festival. That was the only responsibility, and solving some in that caste itself, so problems within the caste problem. There was no sense of being responsible for the whole village, or knowing when the tank had to be cleaned, or whatever, or any sense of being able to stop encroachment. So we were dealing with actually what you might call a headless society in the village. The head carriers had all moved to the cities. Which, for development workers, and at that point, we began to become, now I have no formal training in development. Now you can get master's degree in development work, but at the time when I was going to college, it hardly existed, and when I came here, I didn't. And besides, I wasn't interested in it. The only reason I'm interested in this is because I felt Oregon needed it. And that actually is one of the weaknesses of the particular thing that I did. So we learned about development work. And this is something which I'm in the third part of our discussion. John Robert will give you some examples. After World War II, there was this interest worldwide in helping to assist the development of so-called underdeveloped countries. And at first it was perceived as technology transfer. That we should transfer all the smart things, all the technology and the things that smart Europeans and Americans had thought up and were using, and it was making them so rich and dominant, to these poor countries. Typically, with highly rationalistic things, the whole human element was ignored. And so there were, but after 20 years or so, there were really outstanding examples of total failure. Where, for instance, it had been perceived that, this was a famous one, that there was continual drought in this part of Africa, and therefore there should be wells, hand pumps at a certain definitely scientifically arrived at distance from each other. And so they got the machinery, they got the money, and they got the machinery, and they got the engineers, and they put in all the bore wells and the hand pumps. Later, it was found that many of these hand pumps were never used. And the ones that were used, as soon as they were broken, there was nothing to do, because the people who were supposed to use them had not known and did not take ownership of this new asset. They didn't know who to ask if it got broken, and sometimes they just didn't know what it was. So this was such, and this was not, this is one, you know, it's a particularly clear example. But it was happening right, left, and center all over the third world. And there became an awareness that we need to have a science of development. And this has been very interesting, because in the process, also it was discovered, for instance, that Westerners going in with their assumption of their assumptions about what a male and female role kept on going in and approaching the men about things like agriculture. But in Africa, a large part of Africa, the agriculture was all done by women. And they hadn't noticed it until finally somebody came in and began to evaluate it and looked at it. And then there was, a Singaporean woman, I believe, who began really feeding a lot of information at the UN level about the importance of women in development. So the importance of women and the importance of involving the people, and began to produce an awareness, not only an awareness, but also lots of techniques, development techniques, that are also I don't know if they, how much they were interacting. That would be, and my whole talk is full of possibilities for study. education of children, education of communities. Participatory techniques. I don't know whether they, how much they were interacting, but they were going along at the same pace during the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Actually, in many places, I'm going to come back to India now. In many places in India, the villages became a place where some of the most bright, the most innovative, and the most well-meaning, smart people were trying out their ideas. And there are many, many places in Oroville, or excuse me, in India, where really innovative, excellent methods of teaching children, of involving people, of activating women have come into being because of the efforts of people working with the local people. And as being almost one of them, half one of them, it's a wonderful field because those local people have been neglected for so long that they're extremely grateful. And they're very also malleable because that's what they've been bred for so many thousand years. But you could bring in concepts of grassroots democracy and let them develop within the villages. So this was something that was happening all over India, I know, where you have very, very sophisticated, effective methods of working with people and involving them in their own development. And I think some of these, if later, that's something that could be looked into because as leading edge methods that we might want to dip into as a university, wanting to have not the old teacher-student relationship, but a participatory relationship. There's been lots of techniques developed. That's one for instance, called participatory research and analysis and appraisal. Because you need, in order to write a project to get funding to help the poor people, you have to have an analysis so that the people in the offices can say, oh yes, this is the actual situation and this is what they intend to do. So you involve the people in making the appraisal, and that also prepares them to do the project with you. The other thing is they call action research. Based on the perception that when you research something, it's actually an action. It actually stimulates thought, and very often things change just on the basis of people being asked a lot of questions and being thereby stimulated to think about it and to take action. And there are many other things. I'll go into it a little later. One of the things, and now I'm moving into John Roberts, what John Robert has so kindly put together here. One of the major things that began to hit me when I was doing this work was that I was like fresh from America in a way, and so my approach to poverty was, you know, like, well, you know, pick the person up, dust them off, give them some money and let them get on with their life, you know? And I found that this wasn't working here, and I also found that it had been rather nicely studied in Mexico, too, by some sociologists who came up with the concept of poverty consciousness, which is that if people have been poor for many generations, they have a set of values and behaviors which work in poverty. They work for you to survive in poverty, but they don't work for lifting yourself out of poverty or moving on to another level. And this was becoming clear to me as we worked with the villagers, that they had, because it's so easy, I used to think, this must be what we look like to Mother and Sierra Bindo. Because it's so easy to look at what they're what they're doing and the foolish things they are doing, the things that are going to keep them poor, that are going to again and again result in disaster and failure. And it's very difficult to tell them that. Yeah? I mean, on a very, just one example, but there are so, I don't know which example to use. Like, if many villagers, when they enter into business, will begin to just look at getting as much money as they can now. They have no concept of building up customer relations or the long-term view. So they have a sort of bandit approach to business, which doesn't work. We never got around to actually doing it, Kalyan and I, but we were looking at setting up a business school for villagers to disabuse them of this idea and give them lots of other ideas about how they could build up their businesses successfully. Of course, not all of them have that problem, but many. For instance, handicrafts. Sometimes you wonder, how can these handicrafts be so cheap? Villagers never think of adding in the time it takes them for their labor. They'll just charge you what the raw materials cost them and a little. And they feel almost guilty to ask a little more because they've done it. They're working in a different mindset. The other thing that became clear to me was that for the most part, villagers were headed toward what Aurevilians were moving out of. Villagers, so poor, were headed toward wanting to have material prosperity, wanting to have education, formal education for their children and certificates and that sort of thing. Aurevilians were up to here with that, and we're hoping for moving into a new consciousness where there would be no more need for structure. there was actually one of our brightest Tamil young fellows on this side didn't get an education because nobody on this side really thought that it was important. We were so convinced that and taking so much for granted what we had been given by the structure of our own society, that we didn't think it was worth passing on. And that person still has to make it illiterate. He had so much power and was such an ambitious and well-meaning also fellow that he's done quite a bit, but he always has to have somebody doing the reading and writing for him. So then I began, now we could tune in, John Robert, if you... Yeah? I'm about to go into... Sure.
You were referring to this side, Tamilians on this side.
Yeah.
And a lot of people here might not realize that the more urban kind of development began in aspiration.
Yeah.
And apart from aspiration, none of the rest of Oroville had much structure. It was all very forest-based and very, very rural.
Yeah.
But in aspiration, it was different because a lot of people were coming out from Pondicherry every day. And there were even children being brought from Pondicherry because the mother didn't want to serve those children in the ashram school. They were Oroville-related children, so she wanted something in Oroville. And so many of the young Tamilians who got an education at that time were from Qualifier village, next to aspiration. And many of their peers in Eddie and Chavadi and Kodakarai didn't.
Yeah.
And there was one other point I wanted to make,
please,
about, which I mentioned to you the other night. the idea that the local population doesn't have a business sense and doesn't include its labor cost in its value system, I think comes from
the agricultural base that they have been in for hundreds of years. There they work seasonally to produce the crop, and they sell the crop, and they get the value, the current value for the crop. So the work that they're doing is part of their lifestyle. It's not something that, unless they're working for someone else on the field, and here, because the landlords had left, villagers owned an acre, 2 acres, and many of them farmed their own or their relatives' fields. And so they were only accustomed to seasonal labor. They didn't have to solve any other problems than seasonal labor. And they normally didn't expect to get paid for it, except for what the value of the harvest was. So try and take that mindset and move it into a more materialistic, organized kind of economy. You can understand the difficulties that they have.
Maybe have to take it a little closer?
Yeah, taking it closer is the solution.
Maybe putting it on a chair?
Another solution is to move the board over there.
Oh, and put it on the board. Well, maybe you turn it around. But be careful. Well, we could just turn it that way. So I'm just going to start, John, rather than then.
Just giving you about 2 minutes.
Can I talk over it? Because it'll come.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So one thing that really helped me in my thinking on this was Sri Aurobindo's description of the four castes as what I call a sociological matrix. As it has actually played out in Indian history and society, it was made hereditary, and that corrupted it actually, and it became a social system which has all its faults. But as a conceptual system, it's really powerfully true. What Sri Aurobindo does is to say very clearly, one, that these four levels are in us all, and that any one person will have a particular level on which more of their energy is located. But we're all there, and if we're talking about integral development, we want to develop all four parts of ourselves. So the first part, and this is where the villagers are, is Shudra.
I'm
Or bring that closer. That's it. So Sri Aurobindo is very clear, but this is about consciousness in relation to society. So the Shudra consciousness is a consciousness which is pretty much limited to himself and perhaps his immediate family. And to survival, to getting food for himself and his immediate family. And therefore a person for whom work has to be pointed out and rewarded. There have to be incentives given for the work. The work is something he does for survival. At a higher level of consciousness, and this is, the Shudra is the largest number of people in any given group of people. Yeah? Some people will say up to 85%. Then there's a next level of consciousness in relationship to society, which is called Vaishya. This is where the consciousness is a bit wider. It sees that, oh, if we bring something from over there and bring it here, it might be worth more. If we take something here and we take something here and we put it together, we'll have a thing. If we plant now and then later we will harvest. So it's a business mind or an entrepreneurial mind. Also, the sense of who we is gets bigger. This mind can think of clans, of a whole tribe. Yeah? It has a larger sense than just me and my spouse and children. Then a step higher, and again, much fewer people, but a consciousness that has widened enough to consider large numbers of people, to consider concepts of dharma, of law, of how to organize large numbers of people for things that are going to happen in the future. So that, and that is the kshatriya or kshatriya, and that was in traditionally a warrior caste, and like one important quality of that is a willingness to put your life on the line for what you believe in. In our modern society, probably an activist would be carrying that energy the most clearly. And that, as I said, that's a consciousness which is wider. It just considers more. It considers concepts. It considers large numbers of people. It considers bigger areas of time. Ages, it begins to study history. Then at the top of this system is the Brahman consciousness, which is the consciousness which is particularly conscious of itself. It's seeking truth. It's asking what is consciousness. It's studying. It's teaching. It's advising the Kshatriya. So that and when I began to see it like that, without all the prejudices, like it just becomes clear how important every level is to the whole. And so I began to relax into India's traditional system and into our relationship to the villagers. Because one thing I used to still do, actually, it's very interesting to watch people come into Oroville and see where they find themselves at home. Because it isn't a society in which it's dictated that because you have such and such a qualification, you have to do this or that. You have quite a bit of freedom. You follow your inner call, and you find out where you want to work, and what work you want to do. And it's very interesting. If now that you can think about it, just take a look. You'll see. It'll become very clear how these things work. Now, on top of this, more recently, in the last 10 or so years, I've become aware of a system which has become very popular, actually, among leading-edge thinkers in the West, called spiral dynamics. How many people have heard of this already? Anybody really knows it? actually was really happy. I reread an essay, and I have it, and if people want it, I'll make copies and give. But I was pleased to find that since I first read it, and now I understand it enormously better. And it's as good now to me, it seems, as when I first read it and half understood it, but thought, this is really helpful. So spiral dynamics is based on the work of a man named Claire Graves, the late Claire Graves. He was a psychologist working in upstate New York University, and he's a genius, but he was just working in a small college. He got very tired of having his students, after he had taught them about Freud and Skinner and Maslow and others, they would say, okay, there are all those different kinds of psychology, which is the right one? And he didn't have any answer. And so what he did was to set up an experiment, and it was a long-term experiment, and he was extremely well situated to carry out this research. He was teaching college-age students during the day, he was working in a community college with adult learners in the evening, and he was a consultant for the prison system from time to time. So he was working in a position where he could be in intimate connection with people from many strata of society. And he worked with these people without their knowing that he was doing research, but as part of their courses, they would have to, at one point, they would think about and then write about what are the characteristics of a really mature human being. And so they wrote their essays. And then he had a completely independent group of people read through all the hundreds of essays and categorize them, try to put them in some categories. What are the characteristics of a mature human being? And at first, they made four categories. One category was get what you can now. The world is a jungle. Just don't, devil take the hindmost, unscrupulous, fast, but get it and do it. You know, be yourself. And there were probably largely coming from that prison group, but also in the colleges, especially, he said, after the people came back from Vietnam. And with the GI Bill, they could go to college. So a different type, not just middle-class people, were going to college. Then there was a group of people who felt that what made a mature human being was an ability to put off until later, for heaven or for later, what you want in order to obey the law. That there are things that are right and there are things that are wrong, and you have to obey that. That's level two, or just a level. And then there was another level of people who felt that you should get what you want, but you shouldn't kill people for it. You shouldn't make everybody hate you for it. You should get what you want, but within limits. And another group of people who felt that to be a mature human being would be striving to be in harmony with everyone around, and also would question, receive laws and you know, proclamations about how it had to be. So with those four groups, he did quite a bit of research. He had them he mixed them up to see how different groups would move, if they could change their values, if they would perceive higher values, and how easily they could move. And moving from the I want it now to the more laws thing was easier than, for instance, people who are very convinced that they know what's right find it much harder to move into a a system where you get what you want, but you don't hurt people. And he found that there were bits of this, because he was beginning to perceive this this spectrum. And he found that there were other researchers in other universities in Canada and the United States that were finding parts of it. And what he discovered was that there were two layers lower than the four that he had found, which is the very primitive survival level, of which there are very few existing societies like that anymore. That's almost gone. But you find it at the very bottom in the dregs of society, of people that are fully focused only on their survival and very little cognitive work. And then the tribal level, where people are have they been surviving as humans. And he also found that it was possible to put this in a historical perspective. So after people had survived as cavemen for a while, then they were surviving as tribes, and then they had a received lot of customs and knowledge, and you didn't want to separate yourself from the tribe because your survival would be less sure. And so a tribal society in which people obey what has always been done, the tradition. And then what was very interested and really upset him, actually, at first, was in the 70s, he began to start finding people who were completely different, very, very different in their ability to problem solve and their ability to come up with to work together. There were people who were, and they seemed to have less fear. And they could, if you put them together with a problem to solve, they would solve it five times faster than the group that was mainly looking for harmony. and they would come up with many, many more solutions. So that eventually he began to see that there was a whole gap. It was like you couldn't, the first six were fitting together one after the other, but then there was this big gap into a new level of consciousness. And he found two levels, one where the consciousness is one of wanting to get work done and not being concerned with the with this whole question of how you're surviving in the group. And the next level, and that would be, eventually he saw that it was the beginning of a second group of six. So this would have been the survival level of a new level of consciousness. And then this next level also began to emerge, where people have a consciousness of the whole and of wanting to serve the planet, the large problems that are there, and to also are able to understand that people are at different levels of consciousness and wanting to see that everyone is moving forward in their own capacity. So that's well, now we need those lines. So you can say that the first level, and then there were actually, Clare Graves died before he was able to complete his magnum opus, but not before he was able to totally inspire his two major students, Don Beck and Christopher Cohen. And they developed it further. They did more research and further simplified but made more cohesive what he was doing. There's so much more to this this is, again, many things in my talk are just sort of jumping off points for students to pick up and then study further. There's a lot more about spiral dynamics that I can't cover in such a short period. But just to begin, Beck and Cowan decided that it was easier to give each of these layers a color. And so they colored them. Like beige is the first one. So beige is the survival consciousness. Very simple cognition. By the way, this is just a parenthesis, but I'm reading now a book which is similar to another book I was reading and which makes me think of Vladimir's talking about the Chatur Varnia, not Varnia, the one about school, or education, Chatur. Yeah. That is where he's actually inviting us to go back to a more archaic consciousness. Well, there's a book called Virama that was written here in Pondicherry by a French ethnologist who was studying musicology, and she got to know very well a Dalit woman who was a good singer. And over 8 years she collected she recorded everything that she said, and then because she was a Tamil woman herself, she translated it. And when you read this, you read the story of a life of a pre-literate woman. I don't know anyone that's read it that hasn't felt that they entered into another state of consciousness. It's so powerfully true. And something, that part of us also resonates with it. And I'm reading something now that's similar. It was done by an American ethnologist working with American Indian who had been specially trained by his elders to hold the tribal knowledge. And it's a long story written in the style of that mindset. Very interesting. And it makes me even more appreciate Graves and Cohen and Beck, because I don't know if they were reading things like that, but I can feel that they've really touched into something, because it's our values that change. It's the different values that villagers have and Aurevillians have, or that make Aurevillian values different from the values of the societies we've left, and they're all nicely shown here. So there's this caveman value, a value meme. They call it meme, but that's too complicated. I can't go into that now. Next. Then purple is the tribal value meme set. Meme is sort of like meme set, the value set of the people here. And I describe that. That's where people are very aware of not only of their traditions, but also of the spirits in the nature and of the elements as almost godlike qualities. Yeah, Rod, please add.
I can tell you briefly why they call them memes.
Oh, please.
Because some biologists came up with the idea that cultural evolution is parallel to genetic evolution. And so the cultural unit, which is passed on, they decided to call a meme, like a physical gene.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a simple association.
So the next, and each, actually what happens, according to Graves, is that the success, because these are successive in human history on the planet, the success leads to the next one. So the caveman gets successful enough at just managing to survive that he can dare to join with other people. Then the tribe is successful enough in creating a stable social platform in which people can grow, that the next stage, red, emerges, in which individuals within the tribe, you could say, and then when the tribes are shattered, just individuals say, no, I want it, and I'm the strongest, and I'm the quickest, and I've got the most money, and or the most wealth, and I'm the leader, and they then dominate the society. And in a society dominated by that value set, people who are not strong, their values are going to be... Okay.
Okay.
So in that situation, where the society is run by strong, dominant, aggressive, and violent leaders, then other people have to be quick, unscrupulous, and street smart, you could say. So this actually, presently, we see it in some governments. We see it in slums and where there's gangs. We see it, and we can see it bursting out of anybody if they're presented with a really tough situation. Yeah. Now, red, after a certain point, the instability of that becomes apparent, and then you have a movement, and this happened all over the world in the Axial Period, where law came into society, and somebody, and then there were enough people, other people who said yes to Manu or to Abraham or to Solon or whatever, and there are, it seems, Indian and Far Eastern equivalents as well, where they say, let's have some laws, let's understand the law, and let's set some laws. And first God makes the law, and then it moves on until science makes the law. But we've got some laws, and everybody's subject to that, no matter how strong you are. Gravity is still going through. Hell is still there also for the king. So, and this actually is the value set that I was raised in. I would imagine a lot of us were. Yeah? It says blue, agriculture, religion. Yeah. So we grew up in that, but very quickly the next meme, which is the orange meme, is that was also inherent because that's been around since the Industrial Revolution. Which is based on it has science supporting it, so you have the laws are no longer religious, they're actually like, this is just the way it is, materially true. And you have also business, that you don't kill your enemies, but you you compete with them and get all their money and and you don't worry too much about the people at the very bottom and this whole thing. But it has wonderful qualities. All these things, it isn't that any meme is good or bad. It has both good and bad. It has a positive and a negative function. And then the green meme, we all know also, because this is the egalitarian, communal, postmodern... everything, you know, like, of course, our wonderful Ruth Benedict is the prime spokesman for that, of complete cultural relativity and all this. And actually, market researchers, there's a man named Ray. He was a market researcher, and while he was market researching for the companies in order to sell them things, he discovered that there were so many people in America that weren't falling under his four categories. And he had to find something he calls cultural creative. And these we know this is us. These are the people who don't watch television, who don't buy the stuff, who think for themselves, who may or may not, in our case we're all spiritual, but it may or may not be spiritual, but have a concern for the whole of the economy and or the ecology and such.
You really say that, I say it the other way around. I said all the categories you were describing, they are somehow rudimentary in certain kind of bits and pieces present here in our game.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. That's what makes us so interesting.
The we exists not in that.
All of us That's a very important part of spiral dynamics, is that it does not, it's not like a staircase where you go up and leave the thing behind. Each new meaning includes, so we've got beige, and then we have purple, and we have red. It's all inside us, ready to come up when it's needed, or not needed. And I really pray you, don't take my humble and rather limp, like inarticulate presentation for this thing. It is so interesting, and it's much, if you read it, you get a much deeper and much more articulate and much more loquacious, interesting description of all these things. So then, although we didn't separate it by a big gap, which Graves did, we have the yellow meme. This is actually, should be, you know, three times higher. It's a big change. And I think you may know people like this. For instance, many geeks are of this type. Say, maybe the people who are doing the open source, who spend their evenings creating an open source internet. People who see something that needs to be done, and all they want is the tools. They don't care if you pay them. They don't care, and they know they see it. They see it needs to be done. They want to do it. and that is a type, and it's not concerned with. For instance, the blue person is very interested in their status in the company. The yellow person doesn't care. Just give him the tools. Yeah, you give him, and give him maybe enough salary so he can live. Yeah, then he will work happily.
Some of us still believe that the terminal youth ought to have an education.
Yeah.
In spite of everything.
Right.
It ought to be done.
Right, and Oroville is a place for yellow people. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And what we're missing is the turquoise. Because turquoise is where, now keep in mind now that actually what we're doing is beginning again. Yellow begins another set of six, because what Graves and Beck and Cohen are convinced of, but Graves in a sort of visionary beauty he talks about it, is that it's a never-ending upward spiral in which, as the life conditions change, a new neurological, that was never, as far as I know, it's never been actually scientifically shown, but he feels neurologically the mind opens to a new level and a new value system can happen in the mind of mankind. And so yellow is actually the beige of the next six layer sphere, so it is pretty primitive. But it's still way beyond what we were born into and what we evolved into if we see ourselves as moving from individually, from being born and raised in blue, getting out there and doing something in orange, and finally, and then going on to become green. But there's another big step, and most of us have made it. That's why we're here in Oroville, I would say. But not all the time. Yeah, we're not... It's not that we're established in these levels of consciousness. All the levels of consciousness are there, and we move up and down in that spectrum according to the life circumstances, according to the circumstances around us, largely. There's another thing about this that's worth mentioning, is that they tend to go I, we. So case... At the base level, it's all I and my survival. At the tribal level, it's our tribe that has to survive. At the red level, I again. At the blue level, we have our laws and we're going to obey them. At the orange level, I'm going to get ahead. At the green level, we want to all live happily as one big human family. At the yellow level, give me a job and the tools and let me get on with it. I want to solve this problem. At the turquoise level, again, we, as a planet, what shall we do? How can we manage. So, I find that this is extremely helpful. It's helped me a lot in working in the villages, and with villagers, and with Oravillians. But it is a mental construct. Astrology will do the same thing, you know, on some levels. But I think that it's a helpful mental construct, and one of those ones that we could, as the University of Human Unity, it gives us a bit of an assistance in trying, since we're not yet in the supramental consciousness, to use the consciousness we have to try to understand where we're at with each other. Yeah.
Just coming to my mind, did you try and overlay the Shirobindo's categorization?
Click.
The title and the looking for the text.
So, three or no, I haven't done that. Somebody could do that. Because I'm a busy social worker, not so much, and a project writer, not so much a scholar. I'm trying to change now, next stage of life. So here, I just roughly, I put the two systems together. It isn't worked out, but the similarity is, I think, apparent. Yeah, that what the Vedic seers were seeing is very similar to what Claire Graves, who know nothing about this, know nothing about the Vedas, or he was a very American scientific fellow. But still, that perception of widening consciousness is there invoked. Next. Now this I've put in. Can you bring in the picture? Yeah. Ooh. This I brought in, and this is, I have not done a study on this to really try, you know, but to me it looks very similar that we have at the lowest chakra survival and at the second chakra basic communication, you know, economic communication, sexual communication, at the third chakra power, who I am, at the fourth chakra, the beginning of love, the fifth chakra, expressing oneself, but also expressing oneself from, hopefully, inspired by higher things, and then the sixth chakra, knowledge of horizontal and vertical, and then a higher consciousness above the head. So I just, they use... This chakra system has these colors. It's in the optical spectrum, and it's different from the one that they use in spiral dynamics. But nevertheless, I put the two of them together because I thought, what I believe, I'm an American, and so when I was growing up and in history, I would see maps that were drawn of America by Amerigo Vespucci and Columbus's people and that sort of thing, and they're so funny because you can sort of see that this big thing down here must be Florida, but it's all out of proportion. We have Long Island this big, and it looks funny, yeah. And yet America was there, and eventually we've got it. And I have the feeling that we're trying to map something here that exists in the non-material, that is about the way things are, and that these are attempts. So when I see a similarity like this, and I see it fits quite well, I just thought I'd present it as a spur to thought. Then, next, now to get back to what we deal with in Western sociology, and it, you know, I haven't studied it, so this is is classes, socioeconomic classes, which are based on a material reading of the differences between people. And we have an underclass of the dropouts from society, the homeless, the drunkards, the drug addicts, the thieves, and criminals. And then we have the working class, and mostly that underclass is uneducated. They're not well educated. And the working class is educated in most of our Western societies. And then there's a lower middle class, which is well educated. And then there are, and they're actually, if you were making this spread on the amount of wealth that they control, the very rich control something like 90% of the wealth of the planet. But in terms of what we've been talking about, consciousness, the upper middle class, the rich and the very rich, are still very much in the orange mean. And so, click, we could take a look at these four systems. Again. And I wanted to just to, because the spiral dynamic system also has this historical perspective, like how... Well, actually, yes. I will pass this around. This will give you the spiral. You'll see that it also is historically, you know, like thousands that these have developed over the years on the planet. And I'm aware also of a Vedic system, which is the four stages of life, which is also a time-bound level. And from birth until about 28 years old, you're in the student period. And the values, the things that you have to pay attention to at that period are learning. That's your only job. Learn and prepare for the next stage, which is the householder period. When you have children, you work a relationship with your partner, you have a job, you make a contribution to society, until you're about 54. 56. Okay, 56. When you enter the Vana, or the forest period. Now, forest period is the word that the Indian system has used, because Indian forests are very special. They're full of rishis and ashrams and opportunities to advance in your spiritual life. Very seriously, not laughing. It's actually true. You could leave with your spouse together and leave your family behind, having settled everybody nicely. They're all married. They have the business that you set up, and they continue. And you go into the forest with your spouse, and the two of you study under in an ashram that you find there, and learn how to meditate and develop and learn astrology or whatever there is to learn. And in preparation for, in the Indian system, sannyas, which is when you throw it all down, it means, I was told, and it's when you become wise. So I see that after 84, one's main purpose in life is to radiate compassion and wisdom. And these also show a certain relationship to the spectrums which we've been showing before. And I would invite, if I got a chance to give this as an introductory talk to a group of people who were here, I would invite people in the next month to pick something from any of what's been presented now and after this presentation, because we'll come back and John Robert will give his part. Tea time?
I know we started a bit late.
No, that's okay.
I don't know if
it's 4:30.
Yeah.
We went right through tea. Ooh.
No, it's
time for tea. Okay. Fine. Perfect. So yeah, I would just to complete that sentence that I would be inviting participants in this mutual exploration to pick any part of what has been spoken about as a focus, and to research in it and keep on reporting back how they're doing.
Thank you very much for the break. Yes, maybe we will have a tea break now.
For
the sociological approach. I know that we got it. We will have a session of questions before John Robert starts for this presentation.
Okay. So have quick tea then, because John Robert's presentation requires how long, John Robert? How long have we said we're going to stay here? Today? Oh, then there's plenty of time. No problem. We agreed to six. Okay. There's a very nice essay on spiral dynamics, which if anybody wants, I'll take signatures and make copies.
Oh, good.
I do. I have it in soft copy also and can email it to people. Yeah, you have to tell me, and I will, as I said, I will. I'll make a list. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Very nice. Very lovely. Very nice. Though it doesn't look immediately, so that one has to dwell on it longer to see that there is the same dynamic in every respect of life.
When the